Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 8th of July. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking with the author of 6 Months in Sudan, a young doctor in a war-torn village. Dr. James Muskalic is with us. He is a founding editor of the medical journal Open Medicine, and he spent, of course, 6 months as a young doctor in this war-torn village. He set out for the contested border town in Sudan in 2007. And his experience began really, well, the book began as a popular blog that he wrote from his hut in Sudan in an attempt to bring his family and friends closer to his hot, hot days. It's a story of humane people who suffer hardship because it happens to be their home, and doctors and nurses and countless volunteers who leave their homes with the tools to make another's easier to endure. People, he says, are hungry to be brought closer to the world, even its hard parts. And he went to Sudan and is writing about it because he believes that which separates action from inaction is the same thing that separates him from his friends. It is not indifference. It is distance. And may it fall away. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Muskalic. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email, if you would like to send us an email, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Dr. Muskalic, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
What a story this is. Man, it just kind of rips you open, doesn't it? It really ripped you open as well. Tell me about this decision that a person makes. He's working in the emergency room. And the decision to go to Sudan came a little bit earlier because you had done things in other parts of the world. But to just leave everything behind and go to a war-torn place where the poverty is incredible, where nobody is there really to help in a medicinal kind of capacity, very few doctors, the worst conditions you can imagine. And you had a pretty good life in Canada, so why in the world did you do this?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a couple reasons. And you know, I'd built for myself a medical career whose trajectory was directly towards this kind of experience. And, you know, I knew I would be tested throughout it. I just never really imagined, you know, how well. Mm-hmm. I had an early experience with, you know, the medicine of poverty at a very formative time. I traveled for the first time when I was in medical school. Before that, I didn't know that you could just get on a plane and be somewhere in another part of the world where people had a different culture and spoke different languages. But in between my first and second year of medical school, I got support to do an international medical elective in Santiago, Chile. And you know, I had that, I'm sure everyone can share, you know, that formative travel experience when you realize your story is just one of 6 billion stories. Uh-huh. And properly places you in the world. And, you know, once you get that perspective, it never goes back. But also, I had a chance to work in the public system in Chile. And I realized that if I was being trained to take care of the sick people in society, they just happened to be in other places, or so it seemed. And so that led to an experience in Cambodia, and I got back from there, and these similar questions that, you know, pepper this book and even, you know, I live now is, why should I, as you point out, why should one do this? Why should you leave your home to go somewhere far away to help out? And I remember asking the surgeon who was kind of mentoring me through this experience why I should do it, why should I return? And he said, because it's your bloody duty. That's why. Hmm. And I had kind of stuck with me. And so I just kind of feel until I, you know, willfully choose to do something else, it's my duty to do stuff like this.
You talk about getting on a plane, and part of this is all of a sudden, there you are. I mean, you have some waiting time, I think, in Geneva before you get to the Sudan. But it is incredible how a person's reality and your responsibilities can change so dramatically, and it's all happening at the same moment, just in a different place on the earth, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, certainly on the front side, the transition from, you know, Canada to Geneva to Sudan was, you know, profound and complete. But it's on the other side, on coming back, where the realities don't seem to fit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where you really feel that distance even more than on the approach, or at least I did anyway.
Yeah, I think you start the book, don't you, when you have come back and you're at a wedding. It's a wedding celebration, mm-hmm. and somebody starts talking about the work that he's done, or what was the conversation, and you simply had to leave the conversation.
Yeah, it was an acquaintance who was, you know, in the process of interviewing people who'd worked in similar type of situations before, medical professionals, and just coincidentally happened to be at this wedding. And he started telling me about a friend of his who had been in the Congo working in an Ebola outbreak, and how at one point, you know, Ebola is an incurable virus. And, you know, after watching their patients die day after day, they thought, well, if we can't do anything, at least let's give them a bath. And so they taped he was telling me they taped their, you know, gloves to their gowns and their masks and their goggles. And I said, I can't talk about this. Mm. It's nice to meet you, but I think I'm just going to go inside. Mm-hmm. It just kind of thrust me back to that place about some of the hardest, just in an effort to continue the conversation, I thought of a similar experience I could relate, but there was too much in it that I didn't feel I could enunciate it properly. So that's how I start the book, and that's how it started to make sense of the world.
Hmm. But here you are now enunciating it all the time, right? Is it easier?
Yeah, I think so. It certainly is. You know, I one of the reasons I wrote the blog is so when I knew when I got back, people would say, how was it? And I could say, now I could say, check out www.msf.ca.
Right.
And then they could see for themselves or read for themselves. And so, you know, I got a chance. The book came to me. It was a surprise. I never anticipated that I would have a chance to really tell the stories of this place. But now that I have, I feel that people, even beyond my circle of family and friends, are connecting through it to Sudan and also to the real world.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how it was Sudan you were assigned to. You really wanted to go to a tough place, and I guess you got one of the toughest places on earth.
Yeah, it was, you know, I said I would go anywhere. I'd created a life for myself where, you know, I had no house or car or bills, and, you know, I gave up my job and no family, no one waiting for me to get back. So consequently, making myself an ideal candidate in a way to go to some place that was, you know, very remote or perhaps needed, you know, some attention to security. And my interest, you know, I would have done anything. And I think when people come to me as students or interested other professionals and they want to do this kind of work, I always like to hear them say, oh, I'm interested, I'd love to go anywhere and do this kind of work, rather than, oh, I've always wanted to go to Sudan, I've always wanted to. I said I would go anywhere. I made myself available and, as I point out, a good candidate to go somewhere like Sudan. But in the end, it was just coincidence that I ended up in, you know, a really such a politically complex and dire situation. You know, it's that old aphorism that keeps on repeating itself, I'm sure, throughout the book, but also in real life, is be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it.
Right.
And
you,
so that's what happened.
You sure did. And refresh our memories of all the political complexity. It was a long-term war that you were, it was around you, so it was there, but it had been going on for a long time. Refresh our memory of the North and the South and the battle.
Yeah, you know, Sudan has been, you know, a country united in name only since the British left in the 50s, and the war was largely between North and South. And as most wars, they're over borders and resources, land obviously being an important one. And, you know, the long war, the one that ended in 2005, that lasted for 20, 30 years, Africa's largest and longest civil war, never really crept its way into North American consciousness. You know, Darfur certainly has. It's become a test for our time, and partly on the heels of Rwanda and a vow from, you know, the world to never let something like that happen again. But, you know, the war between North and South Sudan, the one that lasted for 20 years, displaced hundreds of thousands, millions of people, and only ended with a peace agreement in 2005 between South and North. Now, the place where I went, Abier, is right on that border between North and South. And the reason why it's contested, the reason why armies who were supposed to, on the conditions of this agreement, were supposed to back down, were only ever growing in strength and number, is because a lot of the oil wells are around the place where I was. So as you know, wars have often been fought over resources, and so this one seems and seemed threatened to tip into into conflict again.
Mm-hmm. And did you carry medicine with you? How did you know what you were going to you encountered everything. You encountered things you didn't know you would have to encounter. But how did you know how to prepare? Or how did the people from Doctors Without Borders, which is how we think of it, know how to prepare?
Well, you know, one of the reasons why I worked with MSF, or Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, same organization, is that, you know, there's a long history of doing exactly this kind of work. You know, since the 70s, it's been and tried and tested and what medicines and argued about and debated about and thought carefully about. And so this hospital where I worked, you know, with the bones of it, the structure of it, were what was there for 20, you know, 30 years. But the MSF, the medicine part of it, we had our own pharmacy with all of the many of the drugs that you would find in North America. There wasn't a lot of equipment. There was no x-rays and no lab tests, and which made it difficult to make a proper diagnosis. But therapeutically, or, you know, treatment-wise, there were a few things that I wished I would have had access to that I didn't.
Mm-hmm. And when you... I'm sorry.
The challenging part was to make the proper diagnosis, as I mentioned, just because you're so... It's in use, doing medicine like we're used to in the United States or Canada, we usually only treat when we know what the problem is. But in absence of proper resources or proper investigations, you're often left just treating for a lot of different things and hoping that one of them works.
Right. And when you had substantial things happening like accidents, I believe that you had to... Well, there was a hospital that was 3 hours away, wasn't it, that it was better equipped than what you were dealing with? But it was very, very hard to get people to the hospital to save their lives.
Yeah, you know, as we call the golden hour in trauma. So what's really revolutionized trauma care in you know, industrialized countries is that attention to that hour, how the most important part of an individual's care has to happen within that hour to save their lives. And, of course, driving 3 hours in to another hospital. This one had a surgeon at least, and a sterilization, you know, enough to make instruments clean. Was required a patient to be stable. Obviously, it had to be daytime, and you know, all we could offer is no ambulance. We just had a Land Cruiser and would send a nurse with a couple bags of saline or blood if necessary. So, a lot of the time, we were left having to, you know, make really tough decisions about who was even likely going to die, maybe not, you know, survive the 3 hour transfer. Mm-hmm. And that happened, you know, quite a lot. It was a big part of my learning curve, I think, be forced to make that decision.
How hard, huh? Ooh, how hard that must have been. And what a tremendous contrast between what you were dealing with in Canada and what happens there.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, as a physician here, I can say to, you know, I work later today in the emergency room, and if I see someone there who's sick or injured, I can say to them or their families, you know, I can offer you the best medicine in the world and truly mean it. And then when you're in a place like Abier, you can say, oh, I can do the best I can. And when it doesn't work out, I feel, or one feels, that you haven't lived up to your end of the bargain. You know, they came to you for help, and you know that it, in other circumstances, it could be different. But it there's no, you know, very few options sometimes, and so it does that contrast is obvious.
So tell me about the surrounding area where you were living and the number of people who you were to serve and who they were, the kinds of illnesses that were coming your way. There are some extraordinary stories about children who are dying and inspirational stories about children with TB you helped.
Yeah, so, you know, after this war ended, 2005, people were returning to their home for the first time. Mm. And, you know, and since peace came. And it's, you know, always astounding to me, like, why would people call this home? It's so hot. It's so dry. But you, I'm sure as it would be for us to be pushed from where we grew up or fell in love for the first time or you know, played as children, that thought of home is one that sits heavy inside of us. And so too these people as they return to try to live in the place where their parents did or their ancestors did. So knowing that hundreds of thousands of people were going to be returning, people lived a very, you know, pastoralist life, herding cows, moving with the seasons, some agrarian, some farmers growing whatever they could out of the ground. But a large part of the population of Abyei Town was soldiers and military. And MSF does its work as medical humanitarians to offer help to people in distress and people who are suffering unnecessarily. But there's also a focus on working in conflict areas. And for me, and you know, people who work for the organization can perhaps can speak to it for different reasons, but I've always thought of doing medicine as a tool for peace, that not just to treat meningitis and malaria, but to make that hospital a place for peace, where it doesn't matter if you're a soldier or a civilian or from the north or from the south, but it's somewhere where everyone can come. And the only rule is no guns. And if, you know, the father with the kid with meningitis reaches for the water station at the same time as the one from the south, it says to, you know, him, after you, no, after you. Mm. And then maybe 2 days later, they might stop and talk. And 5 years later, maybe have a chat. And I think that's part of what MSF is about, and that's what we were doing there. Most people, as I mentioned, were in the countryside, were hours and days away. People in the city, in Abyei Town, you know, 5,000 or so, were settling there, hoping that peace would last.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest, and we'll take them in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Dr. James Miskolic is our guest, assistant professor in the University of Toronto's Faculty of Medicine, a founding editor of the medical journal Open Medicine. He's the author of 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. And we certainly welcome your comments. And the whole book, which is beautifully written, very moving story, started as a blog during the time that he was in Sudan, dealing with civil war and dealing with a number of people who were quite sick. And they didn't even have all the proper medical supplies and possibility to do surgery there that could have saved people's lives. So for the grace of God, go I, right? And if you want to send an email, try doing that. That address is talk@wpr.org. The phone number again is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Dr. James Miskolic. The book is 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. And one reviewer said this is the kind of book that makes sense of the senseless and builds important connections between those who have seen and felt what he has, those who aspire to do this kind of work, those who want to support the dedicated humanitarian service of others, and those who just want to understand. Why was it that people, and I believe it was MSF, who had concerns, at least some of the people had concerns about your blogs being published at all. They were concerned that you were blogging, and so many people are thankful that you did and that this book came from it. But what were the concerns about writing about all of this?
I'd blogged once for MSF. I traveled in 2005 and wrote about neglected diseases and throughout Bolivia and Africa. And then this was the first time that they officially had a sanctioned blogger in the field. And, well, Canada, MSF Canada was very supportive. The MSF, some sections were a little bit more reluctant. Firstly, it was very new, and I think that the fact that what was a very carefully crafted message being put into the hands of the people in the field, the doctors and nurses and other volunteers, I think went with, were worried about a little bit of control. There was examples of someone who wrote a private blog in Darfur and came out heavily against the, you know, the Khartoum government, which is kind of an unwise thing to do when you're working as an independent, neutral organization. So I think it was partly just, you know, the newness of it was a bit daunting, mm-hmm. but also the prospect of not being able to control the message that was coming out. And I think just as it became clear that most of us who had this opportunity to use a new publishing platform were very careful and understood the intricacies of it, now there's many, many bloggers, many people blogging for MSF, and it's a really great way not only for one's family and friends to get and stay in touch, but also to help diminish that distance right. as much as possible mm-hmm. between us and people who are not that different than us, but live thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls, starting with Tim from Marshfield. Hi, Tim.
Hi. My daughter is working for Windrock in southern Sudan right now around Juba, and she's seen just about pretty much what your guest is stating in the northern part. And she works for a company that Windrock that tries to set up water policy and try to teach the people there that you know, how to grow their own food instead of getting dependent upon handouts from various countries. And she sees the effects of war too. I mean, a lot of kids and a lot of distended bellies and stuff like that.
How long has she been there, Tim?
Oh, she since the end of May.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll be there till the end of August. She's just kind of an intern, setting up conferences between this company and the various officials in southern Sudan. But your guest reminds me a lot of Tom Dooley back in the 50s and 60s when he was in Cambodia and Laos setting up hospitals there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the I'm sure that your daughter will speak to it when she comes back, but I'm curious to see how affected she is by the experience. You know, I think what ends up happening to me, and perhaps the same thing will with her, is that you find that, you know, people, no matter how far you go away, are really not that different than you and I. You know, they want the same things. They want to get off work early, or they want to see their kids for the first time in, you know, all day, or they want, you know, the needs, however, obviously are much different in a place like South Sudan, where people are worried about food or whether they can find their brothers or their kids. And so the fact that your daughter's there is really hopeful for me. And I think that what I've seen, even in the past 10 years or so, is an increased awareness, particularly among younger people, about this, you know, the world that is farther away from them. They understand it in a way that I certainly didn't, you know, 15 years ago when I first started, you know, university. And it's hopeful. Perhaps, you know, we're able to tell people the best things that we know about how to grow their own food or how to pursue peace, and maybe through that help people avoid the suffering that we all went through trying to learn those lessons. So that's congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim, for your call. Let's go to Bill next. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you for this opportunity. I have two questions, one easy and short, one maybe a little more complex. First of all, I guess the easy one, I had this picture in my mind of Sudan as being mostly a desert country. What is the topography there? And I guess the more complex question is, there's supposed to be such a thing as the African Union. You hear about them in terms of, you know, military cooperation among various African nations, taking part in dealing with problems in Africa. But what about humanitarian? I mean, there are some fairly wealthy countries in Africa. I mean, there's the Union of South. There's, you know, South Africa itself. There's Egypt. There's, I mean, some other countries like Libya, for example, could probably. Do you see doctors and aid coming from other African countries? It seems to me the mental picture I have in my mind is that these people have no help at all, except for people who are, you know, kind-hearted Canadians, Americans, and Europeans who decide they want to go over there and help. I'll take my answer off here.
Thank you, Bill.
I'll answer your first question, the easy one first. The topography of Sudan changes from north to south somewhat. It is very dry in the hot season. There's very little rain, days and months without it. And then in the south particularly, it will, you know, instantly become mud and then stay that way for 2 or 3 months before becoming very hot again. In the north, in places like Khartoum, you're right, it'll go 1 or 2 days of rain a year. But as you go farther south in the Sud, as they call it, you can become vast, vast swamps. So it's a large country, the largest in Africa, and does change from north to south quite a bit. In terms of your question about the African Union and you know, it's a longer question with a lot in it. What the people in the mission in MSF, 90% of them are from our national staff from the country. So 90% of people who work in the mission where I did were Sudanese. So that's the most hopeful thing in the world. Unfortunately, in most places in Africa, there isn't an opportunity to have enough resources that you're able to share them very well, with an exception of a few countries, perhaps. But still, even in places like South Africa, which have a great, you know, in economy or have the makings of one, there are still very underserviced places there. And so there's not an opportunity to export, you know, our wealth of talent that, you know, we have in such abundance and are so, in some cases, willing to share. I think that, I'm lucky. I'm able to starting to participate in a program in Ethiopia and Addis Ababa University to help bring emergency medicine there. They don't have it. They have an emergency room for the first time in the last 6 months, but they don't have any emergency doctors to work in it. And after years of sending Ethiopian physicians out of Ethiopia to train and seeing only, you know, out of 4,000, I think 50 came back or 100 came back. They decide that training people in the country is the best way to encourage their retention. And I think that you're seeing that understanding eventually, of course. You know, as I tell students who work with me, is that their job is to work themselves out of one as quickly as possible. So you're right, eventually the African Union will provide the peacekeeping. I think that's everyone's hope, and I think it's a very, very great one. And, you know, the African journalists or Sudanese journalists will write their own stories. And that, I think, would be the most wonderful recognition that of and what they naturally deserve. In terms of, I just want to make one clarification point about the African Union or the UN and humanitarianism. Well, I think that there is some overlap. Many of us who work outside of you know, governmental organizations, of which the UN is one, is a combination of many, is there's this trend towards militarizing humanitarianism to delivering food aid, you know, using soldiers, etc. And what it does is, in my opinion, is blur the distinctions between people who are part of the conflict and people who, like myself, are deliberately outside of it. And so I think that as it's only been in the past, particularly 10 or 15 years, that has been such an issue, but it's one that I think deserves some clarification and attention.
And why was it that only 50 Ethiopian doctors who had been trained elsewhere came back? They just got better, more lucrative offers elsewhere in the world, or what?
I think that's what happens. You know, I need to inform myself a little bit better about the exact intricacies, but I'm sure that it's similar to what happens in other countries, is you get an opportunity to train and not only do more for your family, because you're given a chance to, you know, likely to work in a place where you're able to generate a much bigger income, but even more than that, you're able to send a larger proportion of your paycheck back home to your family. And I think that, you know, even evidence has borne this out, that people who do leave the country, people who emigrate from their country of origin, I mean, they're still very tied, just like you and me. If I left Canada or you left the U.S., you'd always feel that that was your home. Mm-hmm. But I think that they leave in order to send back, you know, much more money and care for their family in a way that they wouldn't be able to if they likely returned.
What about the staff that you had in Abiyá? Who was working with you?
Of the expatriate staff, there was another nurse, a medical or a field coordinator whose job it was to pay attention to security, a logistician whose job it is to help sort out, you know, power and in the hospital and in the compound, and an administrative assistant who helps, you know, paychecks and per diems and things like that. And then with the national staff, made up of, you know, it's a hospital, so there's nurses and drivers and cleaners. And I was lucky to have work with a young Sudanese doctor as well, too, as part of my medical team. And so there were different people from not only throughout Europe and North America, but also throughout Sudan as well, too, who helped very much make these 6 months endurable.
Yes. And it was dusty, wasn't it? It was so dusty. That's what I'm talking to you. I'm thinking about you sitting on a chair in the dust. I know that's not where you are, but that's where I'm thinking about where you are.
I was glad to leave for that reason. I'm from Canada, northern Canada, so I'm not, when I stepped off the plane, it was, you know, I don't know what it is in Fahrenheit, but, you know, 120 or something like that.
Oh.
And it was almost too much to bear, but I can't say I got used to it, but I certainly found some tricks to help me cope. Sleeping outside was one of them.
Right. And how did you keep yourself healthy? There were a lot of diseases around. What did you do to stay healthy yourself?
You know, I got sick quite a lot. You know, made me increase my empathy. And anytime you get sick as a doctor, it only ever makes you a better one, because you realize how much it is terrible to be sick. But so I went for runs in the morning when I could. It's tough because you're supposed to carry a handset with you everywhere you went, because there's, you know, such a could change, the security situation could change at any time, and you needed to be reachable. But after a while, I just would wake up in the morning at around, you know, 6 or so, and just need some space to myself. And I'd run out of town to the same tree in the middle of a field outside of town and just stop there for a second just to feel free. And then I'd run back into town and pick up my handset, and then, you know, I'm tied to that hospital all day and all night. And it was very little opportunity to get that kind of respite. I'm not sure if it's important to everyone to have it, but it certainly was for me. And those few minutes in the morning, I think, were, you know, not just, I think the run maybe was healthy, but I think that just sitting in that wide open space outside of town, not really hearing anything but the dawn birds, I think that was the greatest benefit
going
to my health. Yeah.
Did you do vaccinations?
Yeah, there was. You know, obviously, if someone needed it, if they got bit by a dog that seemed rabid, or, you know, small ones like that. But when I first arrived to Abiyé, there was, you know, in the hospital, one patient with measles, and the next day there was two, and then five, and then 15, and we realized there was an epidemic, and that epidemic of infected people just swept right over us. We had 200 people in the hospital with measles in mm-hmm. April, and you know, in a hospital that only held about 50. And so we started a vaccination campaign and ended up vaccinating 20,000 people in the surrounding area. And by the time I left, there was a few cases of measles smoldering in the countryside, but largely, you know, we'd abrupted it by getting an emergency vaccination team in there and vaccinating so many children.
Mm-hmm. And you asked the question, or somebody's asked the question, why is it that your organization, MSF, had to be in charge of such a huge vaccination and important vaccination campaign? Is there a Ministry of Health? Where was another place that really should be in charge of such a thing?
Yeah, I think that we worked with the Ministry of Health. We shared the hospital. It was a Ministry of Health hospital, but their resources are fairly limited, as you can imagine. You know, the population being who they, you know, as so close to the poverty line as they are, there's not a lot of opportunity to collect tax revenue and improve the health system. So, and MSF itself, and something we take criticisms for, we tend to operate not only very quickly, but also very independently. So when there was an obvious sign of a measles epidemic, rather than spend time trying to work with the Ministry of Health or trying to see what their quick capacity was, we just asked for permission to bring in 20,000 doses of measles vaccine and set about doing it ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I know that you spent some time, and you obviously did preparation of what kinds of diseases you would encounter, and you were picking up books when you were waylaid in Geneva trying to get into Darfur, which took a while, to the Sudan. Tell me about what you saw. You mentioned this earlier, that you were very unfamiliar with diseases that just, you said, what the heck is this, and how should I treat this, and how do you diagnose what you might not be familiar with?
You know, I saw things that I'll, you know, never see when I work in Canada. Things like diphtheria, which is, you know, a young girl die of diphtheria, which is something that, you know, I've never even taught about in medical school, because you don't ever see it, because most people are immunized and essentially stop the spread of that disease. But, you know, things like, I saw so many active cases of tuberculosis, and it became my favorite part of my week, because those people, they got better, and they became, it's such a terrible stigma for something like TB in a place like Sudan. They don't want to admit that they're sick with it, and so you only got the bravest people, and even the reluctant ones. Once they started to get better and once they gained weight, they became the staunchest advocates of it, the most likely to bring in their friend who was coughing and losing weight. And it was such a wonderful thing for me to be close to and to be a part of. And I saw, you know, for the first time, really severe malnutrition. I'd worked with it somewhat in Cambodia to some extent. The population I worked with there was moderately malnourished, but the children that I were, a lot of them in the feeding center in Abyei were, you know, very, you know, close to dying because of it, and many of them did. And it's not something that I was obviously had. We don't get taught very at all in medical school in North America how to deal with it. So I read as much as I could, but there were still so many times where I didn't really know what was going wrong. Maybe all the investigations in the world wouldn't have turned the tide, but at least I wanted to know. So it was a challenge on so many fronts, you know, medically and as well as emotionally and spiritually too.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the story. Your picture is featured in the book of, I believe, the young 8-year-old girl who you treated for TB, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. There's, the woman or the girl that resonates. There was one I treated with, as I mentioned, in the TB program, who got better. But the one who I'm only realizing now, who the book is entirely, the whole thing's about her. Mm-hmm. Is a little girl who comes in early on in my days, was neglected essentially. Her mother died of meningitis, and her father was a soldier and had other wives. And a concerned neighbor brought her into the hospital, and she was just mostly dehydrated. And I remember, went to auscultate or listen to her lungs, and she's so thirsty. She tried to, you know, suck on my stethoscope, and she just needed water. And she was, as I mentioned, an orphaned, and her problems became mine. And the person who brought her in had to leave. And she was about 6 months old or so at that time. Mm. And she just seemed, very quiet. You'd look at her, she'd look away. She just seemed heartbroken in a way. And I felt myself falling in love with her a little bit. And I didn't want to, but I couldn't help it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of my time was spent thinking, you know, she's got all these fevers. How do I make them stop? I talked to my field coordinator about, you know, is it possible to adopt children on mission, et cetera. And after about a month or so once we gave her water and she got a little bit better, she never fully recovered until I started treating her for TB. And then she went from being, you know, this, you know, sad, thin girl to being a normal little one. And I got to see her because of the nature of the treatment, learn how to walk and learn how to talk. And it was such a wonderful part of my day. And I look back at the book and I realize the whole thing is about her. The whole thing, start to finish, is about her. And perhaps we only understand, you know, the unit of human understanding is the story. That's how we understand the world and ourselves. And just like the story of malaria isn't like this, you know, parasite that looks like a ring and a red blood cell under a microscope, it's better to understand it by thinking about the old man who's been sick with it for 4 days and can't go out and tend his fields in rural Burma. And each time he tries to get out of bed, he has to, you know, stop halfway to the door because his fever is too bad. That's the proper way to understand it. Just like for me, my understanding of the reason why I was there was focused on this little girl. And, you know, and sadly and unfortunately, I don't know what happened to her because as I don't think I'm giving too much away to say that, you know, the war came.
Yes.
And that town was razed to the ground.
Yes. The war came after. Oh, what an image to have in your mind after you've gone. The town is gone.
Yeah. Those people who, you know, we were there to try to perhaps bring to an easier future. They, you know, were now, as they probably were waiting for the other shoe to drop, were now fled in the rain to wherever they thought was safe. And, you know, it makes one question, or I get asked the question a lot, how does it feel? How does that feel? Did you make a difference? And how does it feel to not have or thought you were going to when you didn't? And, you know, my answer is that, you know, I'm lucky because as a doctor, I work in the units of the individual. And I know I made a difference because I remember that 3-year-old kid who came in and was never able to walk a day in his life until we treated him for TB, and I watched him stand 2 weeks later. So it might not have meant a lot to the world in general, in my world in Canada, or maybe even the larger history of Sudan, but it meant the world to that kid.
Yes.
And if you look at these big problems in the world, the ones that, you know, are of our human, you know, genesis, they seem so large. But the unit is the same. The unit is the individual. And that's the best part about the solution is the same as well, too. So one person at a time, tell one story at a time to try to get, you know, to try to turn the tide or that grand balance.
We'll take more phone calls for our guest, Dr. James Muskalic is here, and he is the author of, and the book's title explains what it is, 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655. The number, Kay from Iguanago, is our next caller. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I really respect the Doctors Without Borders group. We donate money to them. And that in 1980, even though I have 7 children, by accident, I was invited to go to Thailand. It was at the end of the Cambodian thing, and I was in northern Thailand in a refugee camp for a couple of months. I'm a nurse. With some other people from Milwaukee. And I think what came out of it the most to me is what your guest had mentioned earlier, that once you go somewhere and you're with people of a different culture who maybe they don't even speak your language, it's so forcefully brought home to you that we all care about the very same things and that the human family is one. And it changed my life. I'm in my 70s now. I saw what people go through during war, and I'll never forget it. I just think that it's always the people on the top that make the rules, and it's the little people who suffer. And I still have vivid, vivid memories. I'm a pediatric nurse, basically, of the children that I met who are now in their 40s and 50s, who I took care of over there and saw diseases that I had never seen before either. But anyway, my hat is off to this doctor and to all people who do that. I think it's a life-changing and very enriching experience. And those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Kay, so much for your call. Doctor?
Inspire me.
Yeah, I'm sorry we missed the first part of that.
I said I feel inspired by her. Yes. I think it's one of the greatest pleasures of this has been the chance to connect with people who remind me of why this work is important, that it's a constant reminder that I think that we are all bonded by that lucky circumstance to be alive at the same place at the same time, as Kay can attest to, and I've seen too, is that there's a thousand ways it could be differently. There's a thousand ways that you could be in the wrong place, or you could get sick with something, or there's no medicines. And to be reminded of that by the people who understand the privilege, or that this, you know, being alive in the earth is like being given this gift that I'm not sure I quite deserve somehow, you know, it just seems more lucky than anything else. It's one of the true pleasures of it.
It must also strike you, though, more than once every single day, if not every single hour. Oh, this is all pretty unfair. Doesn't it?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I think that, you know, I have been given a chance to go and work and see these things firsthand, and you come back with an understanding of the world, and you feel distanced from your friends and your family because you feel like of all of them, you're the one who knows what the real deal is. You're the one who understands how the true perspective. And it's sometimes tough to bridge that distance and feel part of the community, and you feel outside of the circle. But just, you know, because of the perspective you have. But I never really felt, you know, angry. I never that's not an emotion that was part of that experience. I was, you know, could forgive people for not understanding, because how could they know? You know, even now that I've been 2 years, I've been back from Sudan, and that feeling of urgency has faded somewhat. You know, I get to talk about it all the time, so I'm reminded by my book or by people like Kay who call in of that very real world. But I think most of the life that we live here are we choose our circumstances because we're so distanced from places like Sudan. I think if we were closer, I think if you could take 10 people off the street and take them to Abyei, 8 of them would say, we can never let this happen again. You know, what can I do? Where do we get started?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you can't do that, unfortunately. We can try, maybe with a book, but that's the truth.
Let's go to Steve from De Pere. We have about a minute left. Hi, Steve.
Hi, a very quick question. First of all, this fascinating conversation. And Doctor, thank you so much for all the work that you did. I was wondering, my background's in the humanities, not in medicine or engineering. And I was wondering, did you work with any volunteers, or does MSN take volunteers from the humanities rather than from medicine or engineering? Thank you.
You're welcome. There is an opportunity to MSF as like two mandates. One is to work with this, you know, and people in distress, populations in distress, and the other is to tell the story. So there's a very strong theme of communications, of trying to be a voice for people who otherwise wouldn't have one, to try to tell the story to people's ears when they otherwise wouldn't have a chance to hear it. And so there is a chance to work with the organization. Don't usually send people away very often to write stories, but they certainly have done in the past, both photographers and journalists. So I would suggest contacting your local office if you're interested and seeing what they can tell you.
And thanks very much for the call. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us and for writing the blog. Thank you. And the book, which became starting with the blog. Thanks very much.
If people are interested in checking out the blog or the book, you can go to sixmonthsinsudan.com and read it there.
Sixmonthsinsudan.com. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Our guest this hour, Dr. James Maskalyk. You spell that Maskalyk, and the book is 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee for all of your calls. Thank you. Tomorrow, during this time period, the author of Yogi Was Up with a Guy on 3rd, and also my husband's going to be here as a baseball reporter. We're going to talk baseball. Thanks for listening.